free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net, see our past lineup of speakers and archives for our previous interviews. Today's guest is Frank Pringle from Global Resources Corp. They have a technology whereby they use microwave energy to turn carbon items into oil and gas. They were featured on Time Magazine as Best Innovations of the Year, or one of the Best Innovations of the Year, as well as in Popular Science, Innovators 2007. So we are honored and delighted to have you on our show. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
Thanks, Sterling.
Well, you've got a magic bullet where you can turn waste into energy. That's congratulations to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a long time in its development.
You're looking at your first commercial plant coming online in 2008, this year.
That's correct. The first machine will probably be doing automobile fluff. It's called ASR. It's a byproduct of when they recycle cars, they take all the metal out, and what's left over is something that right now goes to landfill, and predominantly it's hydrocarbons. When they're taking weight out of cars, they do it by adding plastic bumpers, plastic this, dashboards, plastic. So they take the metal out, all this residue material is left over, and it can be converted back into energy.
And they call that fluff?
Yeah, it's called ASR, or fluff, automobile fluff.
Uh-huh.
You like your headliners, your seats, your carpeting. As I mentioned earlier, the plastic bumpers, again, taking weight out so you get your miles per gallon in a fleet of automobiles. The only way to do it right now is they add more and more plastic, take more and more metal out.
Mm-hmm.
And that has no value other than going to landfills, and we've been able to generate that into very hot combustible gases and some heavy oils.
When you say heavy oils, maybe orient the lay public as to what the use of a
Well, it's a mixed bag. Usually when they make plastics, they're not taking the high grade gasoline, diesel fuels, kerosene. They're on a lower level of the chain, and they convert that into a plastic material. So it can't be any more than it was in its original state, which is a heavy oil that can be mixed with other things to make it usable as a fuel.
Mm-hmm.
It can be cut, so to speak. But predominantly most of it is stays in a gaseous state, and we could take those gases back, chill them back to liquids. But the BTU value of this material is about 2,000 BTUs a cubic foot. Natural gas is 1,000 BTUs per cubic foot, so it's quite hot.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they've been burying it for years in landfills.
Would you be able to, once you have tapped all existing flows of the fluff from the automobile industry and you're converting those into energy, would you then go to the landfills and start digging out the stuff that's been buried there before?
Well, I'll tell you what, someday I think this technology has that application. We're not going to do that. We have too many other easier items to harvest, so to speak, than that. But you're right. There's every day in the United States, in the form of plastics, we bury 6 million barrels in the United States of oil every day of the 21 million that we bring into the United States. 6 million are in the forms of plastic, sneakers, clothes, carpeting, you know, bomb, 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 goes on and on and on. And all that stuff ends up in landfills. So, you know, 6 million barrels a day in landfills, a lot of oil that's sitting there to be harvested sometime.
Well, what are we talking about price-wise for this heavy oil that's coming off compared to what you might get from an oil field?
Well, let's say natural gas. A decatherm is $8 a decatherm. That's a million BTUs. And natural gas is $8 a million BTUs. So for the same amount of volume, we get 2 million BTUs out of it. So it's, I would say that its impact would be more towards the gas heating type of application to power, make electricity.
Okay, I didn't quite catch the price point comparison, though.
Oh, the price of this is we do this for, it's really inexpensive. I would say that if you're looking in barrels of oil, right, we don't get over $30 a barrel to fractionalize the various items that we expose to the microwaves. That's the maximum cost per barrel. And it's a usable, when we do oil shell, I don't know if you're familiar with oil shell.
Mm-hmm. I'm in Utah.
That's out west in Colorado, Utah, out there. There's millions and millions and millions of tons of this stuff in the ground over there, and there's no real good way to convert that oil shell into usable byproducts at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
And when we do our experiments here, we can take oil shell, we expose it to the frequencies that are part of my patents, and we produce diesel fuel and heating oil that comes right out of the rock. Actually, that video is on our website. It's pretty amazing to see a rock that all of a sudden you got diesel fuel and heating oil and combustible gases, methane gases, coming out of it in a matter of minutes. So it's quite impressive.
Yeah. So your technology would both be able to convert our waste stream into energy as well as harness previously unfeasible sources where it's been hard to extract shale, coal, tar sands, and extract energy. So basically, you're pushing the peak oil curve backwards.
We hope to. And it's shows like yours and the recognition that Time and Popular Science and other newspaper stories making people aware of there is another technology out there that eventually is going to come out, and it could really, really be a major player in our quest for energy. In fact, the Department of Energy, I think the story came out on their website in September. They went out and they identified 26 companies in the world that have a technology that, if it matures into production, that these 26 companies have technologies that could benefit everyone in the United States, and we were in there on three of the four categories. And that, to me, was a real testimonial for all the hard work my staff and we all been doing in the lab to have that recognition. And it's a matter of time. This will happen. We've got the answer. It's just a matter of time and doing piece by piece and the steps that are necessary. For example, Sterling, Wednesday we have a meeting in Pennsylvania, and you may or may not know it, and your listening audience may or may not know, but the first oil extracted in the United States was from Western PA.
Oh.
And these oil fields basically have been capped off years ago, and they went off to Texas and Oklahoma, Louisiana, California, because the wells were larger quantities, bigger pools, but the first oil came out of Western PA, and those wells have been capped for 70 to 80 years. And I'm going to give you ask you a question, see if you have this answer, because it's pretty startling to me, and I had this verified by the Department of Energy. They'll go ahead and cap an oil well, and they say, okay, we can't get any more oil out. It's not cost-effective. We can't get it out. The viscosity of the oil is too heavy. It won't come up the straw. And they cap them. Guess what remains in those capped oil wells throughout the world, not only the United States? What percentage do you think stays in the ground?
Number of barrels, you mean?
No, just percentage of this oil well, if they took out a million barrels, what do you think still remains in the ground?
I'm going to guess, I have seen this number before, it's somewhere in the region of 46%, isn't it?
It's 66% remains in oil wells after they cap them.
Wow.
And this remaining oil is not considered a reserve because it's non-extractable. They can't get it out. Now, when we expose a hydrocarbon to our technology, we're not dealing with liquids. We convert the hydrocarbons to gases. So if we, and this is what we're going to do on Wednesday, talking to the state of Pennsylvania, they've got 7,000 capped oil wells that have been abandoned and orphaned in PA.
Mm-hmm.
And that we bring the material up in a gaseous state. It's pre-fractionalized. So when it hits the surface, it can be brought back into a usable byproduct, especially in Pennsylvania, which is the low-sulfur oil fields. We can take diesel fuel out of the ground already fractionalized and heating oil, because that's what happens when we crack this material.
Are you putting your processing unit down in the ground then?
Yeah, we would put a tube into a capped oil well, we'll say. Right? Open the oil well up, put the tube down, turn it on. It would excite the molecules of the remaining oil. Those molecules would then gasify, come to the surface, be fractionalized on the surface, and separated into diesel fuel and heating oil, methane gas. Right in
what?
Farmer Brown's back 40.
Mm-hmm.
So we're approaching Pennsylvania, who has these oil wells and oil fields that have basically been orphaned, 7,000 wells. And there's millions of barrels there.
Well, that's huge.
In the United States, someday in the future, hopefully we can perfect this, God willing, and commercialize it. There is about 60 years of oil remaining in the United States capped oil wells,
mm-hmm,
at 21 million barrels a day. Just sitting there. And they can't get it out.
What's the cost of this process?
Less than $30 a barrel.
Huh.
And again, when it comes out, it's not coming out as crude oil. We're bringing it out as a usable byproduct, especially in Pennsylvania.
So not only you're talking $30 per barrel, but it's already processed, ready to go?
Yeah, it's diesel fuel and it's heating oil and it's methane gas.
So it's different than, it's not really comparing apples to apples when you talk about $30 per crude. This isn't crude.
No, it isn't. It's a already fractionalized byproduct.
Mm. Well, how much... What kind of, I don't have a feel in the oil industry how much money it costs to take that $30 per barrel crude and to turn it into consumer-ready product.
Right now, a refinery, their cost to refine crude oil is about $30 a barrel. So if you're getting crude oil brought into the United States at $100 a barrel, they've got to put at least $30 worth of energy into to fractionalize it.
Hmm. And you're talking, you're able to do the entire process, so you have your finished pipe product coming out at $30 a barrel or less.
Yep, that's what our lab reports are telling us. The governor of Pennsylvania is a pretty forward individual, Governor Rendell.
Mm-hmm.
And he wants Pennsylvania to get back into the oil business, and we're going to go talk to him again. This is like our third interview with him, and I think we're going to get some sort of grant and get some oil wells to take a look at and see what we can do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we're optimistic and we pray a lot.
So basically, your technology is giving a longer lease on this peak oil hype. Well, hype is maybe not the right word, but this idea that we've reached their peak and that oil is going to get more expensive while the demand continues to rise. So,
well, the demand's not going to go down. That's going to go up. But what's happening as a result of the cost of oil, people like myself are looking at various technologies to help in this stressful situation that's quickly coming on the horizon for us all. And I've been fortunate enough to find these microwave frequencies that gasify hydrocarbons in a fast, economical way.
Let's talk, we've not gone into yet the process of how this works. Let's talk about that for a minute.
All right. There are, if you take a look at, if you look at microwaves or radio frequencies, remember, at least when I was a kid growing up, we had to make a little battery-operated radio.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, actually, that is a microwave frequency. It's a radio frequency. And you go from that low end all the way to the high end, and you probably read last year in the Wall Street Journal that, remember when Reagan was talking to the Russians about Star Wars? And it really helped in where Russia is, that they said they couldn't compete. Well, right now there is a radio frequency that is a Star Wars type of frequency that this one manufacturer in the United States is working on, where we could use microwaves to knock out satellites. Not ICBMs. And that's what Reagan was talking about, and they are very close to getting this and harnessing this microwave frequency, and it's well up to scale. We're somewhere in between on our frequencies. See, right now, a nice way to explain this, Sterling, is your microwave at home and your microwave in the office, when you put your cup of coffee in there, they're basically two frequencies, and those frequencies are set for water molecules. They excite the water molecules and turn them, if you leave it on enough, it'll gasify all of the liquid out of your cup. Well, I found frequencies that do the same thing, but to hydrocarbons that are way up the scale of the microwave frequency family. And I do the same thing. I put heavy oil, I put rocks, I put tar sands, coal, and I can take these hydrocarbons and convert them to gases and collect those gases, heat exchange them back to usable byproducts.
One of the things that, as you talk about this process where you're able to selectively, take a specific frequency that is specific to the hydrocarbon to get it to release, whether it's in plastic or tar sands or coal or whatever, or an abandoned oil well, as you were just describing. How is this process going to compare to or compete with other technologies that are also attacking the waste stream issue, plasma arc, methane to electricity? Could your system work alongside, or is it superior to or inferior to some of these others? I mean,
of ours appears that we have a real advantage over others, but we're not privy to all the details of all of this, only what I can read and surf. But I've taken items that, this ethanol, everybody wants to take corn and make it into ethanol or biodiesel and all this other stuff. Now, they do that by using heat in their process.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We generate heat in our process with the microwaves.
Mm-hmm.
In a microwave, and your wife will probably attest to this, she can save about 80% of the time by using microwave to an oven. And it's about that amount of savings in energy. So all of these could be enhanced with our frequencies. And again, it has to do with the frequencies. And what we found, just like the water frequencies that they have in the microwaves at home, we found a family that really go after and absorb immediately. When I take a tire, for example, I hit it with microwaves, and I call it the genie is released, and that is a big cloud of combustible hydrocarbons are released. So all that's left when we're done is carbon and steel, the steel that was in a tire, in carbon. All the hydrocarbons have been gasified. Actually, I ran my diesel truck on the diesel fuel that came out of tires. I produced about 120 gallons of that and ran my truck on it.
perhaps where your technologies work together with some of these others as they get perfected, the plasma, for example, is you could hit it first, extract the oil in the easiest manner, and then what's left over that the could then be put through a plasma process and further, you know, that they can then kind of take it from that point. I don't know if it would make it economically feasible for them to, they need to start with some pretty low-hanging fruit right now, so they're going to the high-tipping fee types of scenarios. But as they become more perfected, it may be that would be
sure.
The assembly line.
Listen, we're all working, at least my group, we talk about this all the time. You know, we need this. Our country needs this, and the world needs this. And any way we get to the finish line that benefits all of us is the right way of doing it. And working with somebody is terrific. In fact, we're looking for strategic partners. We think we might have one in the oil industry. Right now, we've been talking to them for quite some time, and we're about to get an order from an oil company, one of the largest, to do some build a machine for them. I can't disclose that until it happens, but it'll be in our press releases.
Yeah.
But this will be third-party verification of the technology. We're also working very closely with Penn State, and I was just there this past week. We're going to give them one of our tubes that contains the family of our microwaves for them to do experiments and write papers on this with us. So they're all excited about this. Tubes are very, very expensive. But I think it's worthwhile just to have an institution, a learning institution, which Penn State is supposed to be the world's best microwave school in the world.
Hmm.
So we're giving them a tube with our family of frequencies in it for them to do corresponding tests.
Uh-huh.
So they're all excited. In fact, we'll meet with them tomorrow night.
Great match.
Yep. So it's exciting, and again, as I said earlier, Sterling, it's shows like yours that make people aware that there is hope. We really have something, and it is economical. And it one of the things that I have to stress is we don't do anything in an atmosphere that is with oxygen. We do it in a vacuum.
Okay.
So we have no CO or CO2 releases. We're entirely environmentally friendly. If the subject material, for example, coal, bituminous coal has maybe 6 to 7% oxygen trapped in it, and that would come out. But we're not burning this coal in oxygen environment. We're just cracking it and releasing all of its materials. We get hydrogen and methane gas out of it and coke material for steel manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really exciting. Around here, if I'm not on the phone talking in to people like yourselves, which I have to do, in Wall Street, which I have to do, but I go out there in the lab and do experiments, it's just amazing. Just amazing. When I was fortunate enough, the Lord gave me this challenge or burden, but it's there. It's real.
How long have you guys been working on this?
Geez, I discovered this frequency in 1998, and I've expanded the frequency since that time. So it's been a while, and it's been a tough road. People just, even though we have a gas chromatograph, and I don't know if you know what that is or your listening audience, after we fractionalize something and gather the gases, we gather the byproducts, we put it in the gas chromatograph, much like that show on TV where they're always trying to find the criminals, and it tells us what we're producing. And we know how much energy was necessary to cause this to happen. So we have a pretty good handle of this in a lab situation. But the results are awesome. People that come here, like Time Magazine and Popular Science, the Department of Energy, this major oil company, they're all quite impressed with us. And we are just going one day at a time going forward. And we go forward more than we go backwards, and that's the good news.
Well, that's always good. With all this attention that you've gotten, have you now gotten the money, funding, and partnerships that you're, are you busy enough, or are you still, is there something that you're still looking for or waiting
well,
for?
Well, in a perfect world for Christmas, all right, we'd like to have, like this oil company I mentioned to you earlier without disclosing the name.
Mm-hmm.
We want to get into that game, and that's where we can benefit the world. And by getting this one, it's a small step. It's one machine that may lead to a 1,000 machine order.
Mm-hmm.
But it's using microwaves in a major industry, the petroleum industry, that I think this will be the step that'll get us the recognition where we'll look at other applications from our lab results that'll benefit us all.
The two directions that you can go with this and are apparently pursuing both directions right now, the waste stream on the one hand and
exactly.
The natural resources going into existing oil wells that have been capped, going to oil shale. Do you see yourself turning it to two companies, or do you think you're going to keep it in one?
Well, at this point in time, and you're right to correctly identify that, we're building machinery for the waste industry.
Mm-hmm.
All right? We have a manufacturer in Illinois that is a major boiler manufacturer company that's going to build our hardware. We're buying our tubes, and we hope to soon to manufacture our own tubes. And that's an industry that I think we'll always be making equipment for because it's needed. But the big piece of the pie, I have a pie chart on my wall, and it includes shale, slurry oil cuttings, coal, tar sands, and capped oil wells. That's the one I'm trying to get in through this one oil company. When that door opens, I believe that the recognition that will come with that will allow us to get a strategic partner on a large scale to start to explore this and try to commercialize it. It'll benefit us all. But of course, as I said earlier, Wednesday we have a meeting with Pennsylvania, and all I want from them is a capped oil well one,
mm-hmm.
and the grant to go do it, go down and extract these byproducts I mentioned earlier that would come out of the well and show the world that, look, we got a lot of oil still remaining in capped wells in the United States. And for that matter, the world. Because only one third, if you go back and look at all the oil that was taken out of the ground since 1900 and say that equals one third, there's still two thirds remaining in the ground that can't get out. We could have years of this situation of fossil fuels. So it's quite large. The magnitude of it is we'll build machinery, we'll go ahead and do what we can from the standpoint of a waste stream, but the big, big piece of the pie is the oil industry and the coal industry. And that will come. That
yeah.
will come.
Well, let's talk for a second about the scalability of this. How small could you go and how big could you go with this?
Well, we've got drawings that we've made here on all the machines. And, of course, when you're thinking about everybody's gone on the Pennsylvania Turnpike that lives out here, and they've seen coal, when they're stripping the ground and they're taking the coal out. I mean, you've got to have large machines. We've drawn machines that can do 3 million tons of this a year. So we have the drawings and the understanding of what's necessary from an engineering standpoint to make this. Now, since the recognition, I just want to bring this up that you mentioned earlier, Time and Popular Science and probably about 20 newspapers across the United States, we're getting about 10 inquiries a day from the world.
Wow.
We had people from Saudi Arabia, Oman, they're coming in from everywhere, South Africa, Europe, and we're getting active projects with them. So it's just a matter of time. But we're getting 10 inquiries a day as a result of all this.
Yeah, that's great. I guess part of the reason for my question is I'm curious if this is something that we could actually implement on a home level anytime soon, where you have a microwave to cook up your food, and then you have a microwave to get rid of your trash. and it turned
into
oil.
That's a good thought, and that's something that I think it would be more like a hospital or a school.
Mm-hmm.
Could take materials that would be going to the landfill that could have a small boiler and a generator to generate enough energy to run the whole place, cool it, heat it, illuminate it. That's feasible. That's feasible now, within 7 or 8 months from now, where this could come into play. That's real. That's real. Down to the home level of an air conditioner-sized machine out back, maybe someday that could work. But staying in along those lines, and I hope you don't think that I'm crazy, but we do experiments. In the last 6 weeks, I did 3 items that are pretty exciting. Going back to the home unit that you referred to, over here on the East Coast where we all live, abundance of trees. So I took fallen leaves and microwaved them and got some gasoline, some methane gas out of it. Back to ethanol with the corn kernels. I took a corn plant, right, without the cob, and I was able to convert that to energy. I've took some of my grass cuttings, also converted that to energy. You know, all of those things convert to methane in time in the ground.
Right.
We just accelerate the process.
Mm-hmm. What about a big industry right now in energy is algae?
I read about that. I've done some experiments in it. And again, if anybody can get energy out of a material that is using a heating source like electricity or fossil fuel, the microwaves would just do it a lot faster and more economical.
Mm-hmm.
But all of that material in 5,000 years will probably be coal or gasoline in the ground. So we can accelerate that process. You're right. We've done experiments on it. Well, I haven't concentrated on them. It's like, what if we try this and what if we try that? We get the byproducts, we check it out in our chromatograph, and by God, we're getting energy out of it.
Is your process such that it needs to be batch, or could you have a continuous flow scenario?
Continuous flow is the way it's got to be. And that's the design of our equipment, on a continuous flow basis, most assuredly.
Huh. Because the videos you have on your site show more of a batch process. You have
it is. That's our lab. We're going to have a continuous machine in February that we're going to have an open house show and tell on it. Because everybody said the same thing. Well, you know, this is great in a lab, and you know, you do all this, you draw the vacuum, you have all these control factors. What happens in a continuous? So we're having Ingersoll out of Illinois build us a unit. And in February, we're going to do experiments. And actually, Penn State is begging for the machine when we're done with our open house because they love to play with it.
Mm-hmm.
And who knows, we may give it to them. But actually, we have somebody who wants to buy it, so I'm torn. It's just a one-ton-an-hour machine.
Well, processing 1 ton?
Yes, 1 ton per hour.
I'm curious, how would you, with a continuous flow, how would you establish your vacuum?
Good call. You must be a technocrat. That's good, Sterling. What we have to do is we feed it in through a gate system, and then the material falls into a screw conveyor where we draw the vacuum in the screw conveyor before it enters the main chamber, and then we're in our vacuum as it comes into the main chamber where the microwaves are exposed to the whatever the product is, and then it discharges back into a lock and then a screw conveyor that takes it away to maintain the vacuum. And this will be on the prototype unit that we'll have in February. It's being built right now.
Is this something you're going to license out, or are you going to... are you going to, you know, build products and operate products yourself? How is this going to work?
Again, on the recyclables, we're just going to manufacture machines for people, for tires, for automobile fluff, for MSW, which is municipal solid waste operations. those all can be machines that we build and we send out 5-ton, 10-ton, or 15-tons an hour systems that we have designed. But the capped oil wells, we're going to do our own capped oil well. We're going to do the first one ourselves. We have a design in this tube that is special design with special frequencies. And once we show the world that we can take what's in the ground that can't come out with a straw to the surface is coming out as a marketable, usable material, then that just opens up the door for the whole world for this technology.
Are you going to do exclusives, or are you going to make it available to any company that wants to use it?
Well, I think when you talk about the big pie, which is the oil and the coal, that we're looking for a strategic partner. Obviously, that's going to take hundreds of millions of dollars to do it in a grand scale of oil shell or bituminous coal. And that's going to require these one of these big guys saying, hey, he's got it. All right, let's take this now and let's put it through its task and start to mine this and start running it. So only time will tell where that's going to go, but eventually it's going to be there because it's economical, it's environmentally friendly, it's got all the pluses and the downside. There isn't any downside that we can find at this point in time.
What about coal tailings and tailings from other mining operations? Would that ever be, is that kind of at the top of the tree, or where would that be in the vernacular of a low-hanging fruit?
Well, bituminous coal. Right, and I don't know if you saw this on our video. We do an actual test on air. We take bituminous coal in solid blocks of coal. We put it in about 25 seconds, we're getting hydrogen and methane gas out of it, and it's done in less than 3 minutes in its entirety. All right? That, to me, is like everybody wants hydrogen for fuel cells. There's no good way to make hydrogen. Half of the gases that we do in that three-minute example that I'm talking about, half of those gases are hydrogen. That can be separated from the methane, and now you have a source of hydrogen for fuel cells that are really economical. It's like $8 a ton to do bituminous coal, according to our calculations.
Wow. For the layperson, bituminous coal, could you explain what that is?
Yeah, you have anthracite coal, which is in the eastern part of upstate Pennsylvania, and then you have bituminous, which is a little bit softer coal. And there's more bituminous coal in the United States than anywhere else in the world. And it's a little bit softer than hard coal. It has just a little bit different chemical makeup. At this point in time, I have not found the frequency for the anthracite, and I am still experimenting. Eventually, I'll find the key to that door, too. But right now, bituminous is poof. The genie jumps out of that in seconds. And that's something that, anything in coal, the biggest downside of coal, it's a great fuel source, is CO and CO2 emissions. We have none. We have none. Right now, the steel industry is buying coke from China because of the constraints on making coke in the United States and the CO2 emissions. So we're buying it from China in 12 hours. Where China was, we are breathing the same air that China put the CO2 into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense, does it?
Nope. Then you have the shipping cost, too.
Yeah, exactly. But that's another one. Now, we're working with West Virginia University on that. And we hope with working with them on this, who's one of the biggest coal schools, that we'll get enough recognition working through them. See, we've got to go. Well, what we're finding is that here we are in South Jersey. Now, we know microwaves, but the materials and everything else, this one oil company that is going to give us our first order, this gentleman said to me, he said, well, you know, this is amazing. If you can do all this, this is really outstanding, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, but what are you doing in South Jersey? You should be in Oklahoma or Texas. And I said, well, this is home. But through that phone call, we are going to get an order from this company.
What's your investment model for people who want to invest in this technology?
Well, presently we're a pink sheet company through a mistake internally on our part in filings. We're anticipating, we hope, to either go on big NASDAQ or American Stock Exchange in sometime this first quarter of this year. But we're right now as a pink sheet company. I think we're trading about $3 a share. And we believe that, we hope that when our developments become commercialized, that those shares will increase in value.
Okay. What about your international scope? What's your plan for rolling out internationally?
Well, just recently we licensed a company in Canada. And what it is we're getting all these inquiries, and we're looking at other companies in other parts of the world to license them as a marketing group to find other, hopefully, strategic partners. And that's something we're exploring on a regular basis. And again, most recently with all the publicity that we've been receiving. And our hopes are very optimistic. We've had several people in the last 30 days talking to us about wanting to rep us throughout the world, various parts of the world, rather.
I would think that with the attention that you've gotten, that your biggest problem right now would be growing too fast.
Well, it's really tough to handle all the inquiries, because just imagine, let's say that you're somebody in Africa and you've got a product and you want us to take a look at it. And it takes, it takes maybe about 2 days to find the right frequency for your product. But we have all of these other people that are ahead of you. And staying ahead of the curve, it's a nice problem. It's a nice problem. And it's something that we're trying to fight our way through it. We're trying to hire more people as a result of this. I'm probably going to hire someone that's going to be my president, and so I can go out in the lab and just be the CEO, because I enjoy that more than talking on the phone and doing interviews and stuff like that. To me, my fun is go out there and experiment and say, well, why don't we try this? What if we do this combination?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it's at. And then when you get the results, you say, wow, truly amazing. But we are growing. And you're right. It's a nice problem. We're getting a lot of inquiries and trying to orchestrate those correctly and try to make sure that everybody gets a fair shot at what we have here. It takes time.
Let's talk for a second about your IP. You've mentioned patents. Are you filing more? Do you feel like you're well tied down? How's that?
Well, we've got. I think we have a family of like 8 patents right now for 8 applications, all different frequencies, all different vacuum combinations and various machines. And as we stumble into and we do a what if we try this type of thing, this family will probably grow in scope. And we have one of the best IP companies, law firms, over here in Philadelphia, Woodcock and Washburn. They're quite good in what we give them with the support documentation we give them from our tests, with the data from the microwave, then with the data from the GC, and then the drawings of the support equipment that would be necessary to build this. There's nobody that is doing this. It's just a matter of time for our patents to come through.
Mm-hmm.
They've all been filed. I think I have 8 of them right now in this family, and that probably will grow as time goes on.
What about your international patent? When are you going to start doing that?
Well, you know, that type of thing happens once you get the U.S. patent and then you piggyback it. I've got 7 patents from other developments I've done related to plastic bottles and glass. You know, I've always found, let's get the American one and then we use that as the piggyback to go get the international patents.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the structure I'm going to maintain. Woodcock Washburn seems to think that's an okay way of doing it.
What do you see as your logjam or I guess this is two questions. The log jam is number one. If there's something that's kind of holding things up, number two would be what would you see as being the downside of the process?
Good question again. Good question. The downside is the tubes that are required for our applications are special. And there are frequencies that we've found that to make these, there's only two manufacturers in the world that'll make these in capacity in their production schedule. So the downside is producing the tubes. If you recall earlier, I said we're looking at seriously about setting up and building our own tubes. This is to assure delivery and also keep the technology in-house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest problem that I see in this. For example, our projections, and I'll just tell you, hold on, I just had it done. It's on my desk as part of today's meeting. Warning meeting. This year, my salespeople have come back to me and said we need 760 tubes to be to fulfill their projection on the conservative side. 5 years from now, their projection is 2,670 tubes in a given year. That year, the fifth year. So the short pants would be getting enough tubes for the demand. And that's why we're looking at financing our own operation to manufacture our own, mm-hmm. to build up to the 2,670 tubes that would be necessary. See, one of these machines, a 10-ton machine, requires 40 tubes. So you can imagine if you take 40 and start dividing these numbers out, the scope of this.
How robust is the machine? Is this something that's going to break down every year, or can last
4 years? They're boilers, and again, Ingersoll, you've heard of them probably. Most people have. A large company in Illinois does a lot of automobile work for all the big giants. They're signed on to make 25 machines this year for us, and that goes up each year. They're built like a boiler. I mean, that's what they are. Basically, are boilers for the gas and the containment of all this. And the tubes have a life expectancy of about 6 years on a continuous basis. They ran 24/7.
Uh-huh.
So in theory, it's a good combination. The machine, you know, machine lasts 7 years. That's a good lifespan for a machine. And we're trying to, basically target that as our life expectancy. And then the tubes would have to be replaced. There might be replacement parts, like any machine, handling 10 tons an hour or 15 tons an hour. You can have wear points in it. But that would be something that just be general maintenance and general change out of various hardware.
Mm-hmm. If the country or segment of the country were to get behind this technology in an Apollo project type of spirit, would this logjam of these tubes prevent it from, or would part of that effort be to ramp up the tube production as well?
That's it. The whole thing would be scalability. I mean, if the government got behind this and sees this and frees up. See, they have a lot of money that they say is available for research and development for alternative energy, but have not released the funds. So we're funding ourselves as we go forward. Let's say that all of a sudden the Department of Energy that's been here three times say, hey, Frank, we got X amount of dollars for this development. Now let's get this thing going. It's just put more people to work and buy more components and you make it all happen. It can be scaled up, I guess, is the answer you're looking for to accommodate. I believe 5 to 6 years from now, we're going to be free of a lot of the problems we're having in the Middle East with this technology as it becomes mature in its productivity.
If this had an Apollo project type or Manhattan project type of energy put behind it, impetus, would the ramping up of this thing enable, how quickly do you think we could get to the point where we are no longer dependent on foreign oil?
Well, I said I thought 5 years would make a big impact. 21 million barrels is the target today that we consume in the United States. The Shell oil fields out in the western part of the United States, all right? The Department of Energy has a whole study on oil shale. Before they came here, they said that if you can gasify this oil shale and extract 15% out of the rock that's out there in these oil fields, that there's 400 years of oil out there in this form, in oil shale. 400 years at 21 million barrels a day.
Wow.
We get 30% to gasify. We get twice as much as retorts, and the known technologies right now that people are experimenting with,
uh-huh,
our yield is twice as great.
Wow.
So if there's 400 years out there, Sterling, you know, maybe there's 700 years with our technology. So if they just went out to the western part of the United States and said, let's make this thing real, you know, again, it's like a Manhattan Project. We have the ability to gear this up, and we could say, we don't need those people out there in the far Middle East. So it's just a matter of time. And recognition. And again, recognition is what's needed. People talking about this guy in South Jersey that God put this cross on his back to carry up the hill of Calvary here. I'm going to get there. And by spreading the word is what's necessary.
We're coming up toward the end of our segment here. Is there something that we've not addressed yet that you'd like to bring up?
I think you did an excellent job of inquiring. I think we've covered the gamut. It's really exciting. We'll be making some more press releases, and we have some. We hope to get a big order here shortly for these ships that come in to the western part of the United States. That's where you are, aren't you, Sterling?
Yeah, I'm in Utah. I was born and raised in Boulder, Colorado. So,
okay, well, you know about the oil shale, but out in California where these ships come in and they pump out all the oil that's got to be processed, these ships have a bunch of this sludge they call back there, or they call it out there, and we can take that sludge and convert it into energy. And we're anticipating a nice first-step project from the refineries out there to do this.
What about from a refinery point of view? What if you took the crude oil and ran it through your process as opposed to the refinery process?
Well, I haven't looked at it from that standpoint. What I did look at, each refinery every day produces 5% of its total production comes out as a heavy oil. It's called slurry oil, if you look it up on the website. And they can't fractionalize that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very viscous, and it just it won't fractionalize in a fractionalizing tower. That's 5% of all the oil every day. We can take that stuff and make it into useful materials. And that would be a downstream part where now every day 5%, which is a million barrels a day, this stuff comes out, and they're trying to find, they use it for roads, for asphalt, they use it for roofs, for pitch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you ever seen anybody taking blocks of tar and they're turning into hot buckets, and they put it on a roof and they swap it down?
Yeah.
That's resid oil. That's a byproduct of the refineries. That stuff has very little value. It's $3 or $4 a barrel. We've taken that from two of the refineries here on the East Coast. We actually turned it into gasoline and diesel fuel.
I know something that we've not addressed that I wanted to ask you about is on the waste-to-energy paradigm where you've got, you know, when I haul my trash out and I put it in a trash can, you've got all kinds of junk mixed in there together. And
sure.
If I understand your process right, you kind of need to have a little more of a homogeneous inflow for this thing to work most effectively. How do you prepare the inflow in an economical sense in terms of the waste-to-energy paradigm?
Well, right now we're talking to two companies that are MSW, Municipal Solid Waste, and there's a blend of materials that are coming in from that called Municipal Solid Waste that we believe we take about 50% or 60% and turn it into fuel. So therefore, what would be left over was just a carbon ash that would not be a negative byproduct. And we could reduce that flow by about 50 to 60% from the tests we've done. Over here on that car waste, we're reducing it by 70%, that fluff I mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There's enough of that in there. So municipal solid waste, the experiments we've done is 50 to 60% would be gasified and converted into energy.
Well, Frank, it's been great talking to you. I appreciate you coming on the show. We've not given out your website address yet. What is that?
All right, hold on. Let me pull it up.
Source Corp.
It is www.globalresourcecorp.com.
We've got a feature page about you at pezwiki.com. We've got you listed in our top 100 energy technologies ranking.
Well, thank you.
And
you do this very well, Sterling. You had asked some really great questions.
Thank you, and we wish you the best in your going forward, and hope we can have continued communications as we find good partnering matches for you.
Excellent. I appreciate it. Thank you so very much.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.